Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
It is 8:08 in the Twin Cities, 50 degrees. Time now for one of my favorite guests, the one and only Professor David Schultz of Hamline University.
How are you? I'm doing very well. How about you?
We have not talked in quite a while. I know you've been traveling a little bit, and certainly, as always, an awful lot going on in this political world.
No, you're absolutely correct. I think that since the last, I can't remember, when was the last time we talked? Was it January?
It's been a number of weeks, yes.
I don't know when it was, because you're right. I was in Ukraine for a while teaching, and then, of course, all the Timberwolves games. And so it's been a while since we've been able to mesh our schedules together.
Right, absolutely. Well, it's great to have a chance to talk to you. I do want to ask you about the presidential race and the latest candidate or possible candidate to be snagged by the Me Too movement, Joe Biden. What do you make of all this?
Well, this is interesting because all the polls are indicating that, at least up until recently, that he's the front runner for the Democrats. And just to put it into comparison here, you know, he's polling in the upper 20s, according to, you know, many surveys. Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota is around 3%. So that just sort of puts you the kind of the comparison here. You've got Biden, you've got Sanders, and then you have a big gulf before you get to somebody like Elizabeth Warren or Kamala Harris. All right, so he's the front runner, and this is going to be interesting to see how this plays out here, because you're right. In Minnesota, again, we know that the Me Too movement, you know, snared Al Franken. We know that it's had a significant impact, politically in the country among Democrats. It doesn't seem to have had a major impact with Republicans yet, although one could argue that 2018 election with suburban women coming out was in part a result of Me Too movement. But Biden, I think, it's going to be interesting to see how he negotiates these accusations over the next few weeks because, I mean, it seems pretty clear he's planning on running at this point. I can't imagine he's not. But he doesn't seem to... I'll retract and say it's not clear how he's really navigating these accusations and whether or not his responses are adequate.
All right. And it's interesting that you mentioned Al Franken because I've seen a few articles that talk about the Al Franken situation, and there are so many, many Democrats here in Minnesota and here and across the country who feel that he resigned too quickly. Mm-hmm. And yes, there are differences, but in terms of what people are saying about what Joe Biden did and what Al Franken allegedly did, but there are certain parallels that I think are difficult to ignore. What do you think about the Franken situation as it applies to Joe Biden, or does it not apply at all?
Well, again, I think this is becoming a very complex question. I say that because you're right. There are many people who are saying that, I'm going to say this, at least two camps here. Camp one that says that any type of offensive or inappropriate touching is grounds for excluding somebody for running from higher office or for holding office, which is sort of the push that, let's say, Senator Gillibrand from New York, you know, putting the pressure on Franken to be out. And that's, I think, a lot of the Me Too movement. But there are also a lot of people within the Democratic Party that are saying a variety of different things. You know, one of them is to say that there's significant differences in the type of action that Biden has engaged in, and therefore that shouldn't exclude him. Or some saying that that we have to judge Biden's actions in a larger context of let's say his politics and his ideology, and maybe perhaps you can't get 100%. You know, this is some people saying in terms of somebody who's perfect on a lot of things, or some people saying that, well, he's given his age, he's a reflection of a different era, and things that he did reflects a different era and different time. So this is, so all these become very complex answers from, let's say, different constituencies within the Democratic Party. And in part, I think what the 2020 presidential election is going to be about is to what extent the Me Too movement imposes a litmus test upon candidates for office in terms of how we judge them, not just for, let's say, present activity or present actions, but let's say their past behaviors.
Well, and I think that, you know, remains to be seen. I do think that it's prompting certainly a discussion about that. And I agree with you, you know, Joe Biden's sort of saying, hey, I get it now. And he's saying sort of this is, you know, a new era or whatever. But I don't think that most men who are in their 70s are going around and kissing the heads of people they've just met. You know, it's
I agree, and so this, you know, and he wants to respond by saying, you know, that I'm a tactile person or something like that. I think
right.
It's the phrase that he was using. You know, I think you're absolutely correct. Is that I don't know of too many people, you know, regardless of age, who do that we wouldn't generally describe as somebody who is doing something wrong or would say that they shouldn't be doing something like that. It's inappropriate. But I think where we're getting the debate with Biden also, and this is where Al Franken comes in, is that there's a lot of Democrats who are saying that, look, you know, we're kind of being hypocritical, or let's say, or the other side's being hypocritical, that is the Republicans, that people like President Trump have done far worse and no pressure is being exerted on him within the Republican Party to oust people. Why should we be holier than thou and impose this rigid litmus test? And again, some people are saying, and again, it's not me, so hopefully listeners don't shoot the messenger on this one, saying that, well, listen, you know, even if Franken did all those things, politically he was still pretty good on every other issue. Therefore, you know, we lost him and we shouldn't. And I think you're saying the same thing now. The stakes are so great with trying to oust Donald Trump. Shouldn't we just overlook some of these behaviors of his and keep an eye on the presidential prize instead?
Right. And I think you raised a really important point, and I think the same thing appears to be applying to the president himself, who is mocking Joe Biden for the very thing that he has been accused of. He's been accused of worse. I want to take a quick break, but let's talk about that when we get back, because the president going full bore on Joe Biden, attacking him on this, which is remarkable. Because, again, he has been repeatedly accused of even worse behavior, yet it doesn't seem to stick to him. And maybe his supporters are saying there's too much at stake to worry about this. I think maybe it's the exact same thing. So let's talk about that when we come back. You are listening to News Talk 830, Esme Murphy, along with Professor David Schultz. The Twin Cities, Esme Murphy, along with producer Shaletta Brundage now, talking with Professor David Schultz of Hamline University. We're talking about the situation involving Joe Biden and the fact that you know, when this came out, the president has gone after Joe Biden, attacking him for these accusations that he acted inappropriately, even mocking him on Twitter with a doctored video with Joe Biden basically sort of molesting himself. You got to see it, folks. But the president just really going intensely against Joe Biden. Obviously, the president has been accused of this and more, and yet it doesn't seem to affect his support at all.
No, you're absolutely right. And it reflects a few different things here. One of them may be the fact that if we were to look at the basis of the Democratic versus Republican parties now, there is a dramatic gender gap between them. And what I mean by that, far more men are members of and consider themselves to be Republican than Democrat. And we have an incredible amount of psychological and sociological data that supports the notions that what men and women find offensive varies pretty dramatically. For anybody who's ever gone through, like you have, probably I have, sexual harassment training at work, you know, in terms of what not to do and things that you have to be concerned about. We know about those differences. And so one of them may be that that reflects what? His base looking at the world differently than the Democratic base, which is more female. Second, it may be that this is an issue that's not important to his base. Third, it could be that they find that the issues of immigration, of, let's say, trade, to be much more important, and therefore allegations against Donald Trump about sexual inappropriate behavior are discounted compared to Democrats who seem to put a stronger premium on these issues.
You know, one of the things that is so interesting to see is that, you know, the president obviously hammering on this, obviously loving the fact that the person he sees as his chief rival, because according to a number of reports, he really feels that Joe Biden is the one who is the threat to him, is embroiled in this. And you see the president just continuing to do this and continuing to focus on Joe Biden in this way, obviously feeling that this is something that's going to win him support.
And I think this is a winning strategy, too. If we look at what he did incredibly successfully during the 2016 Republican primary season, he would find the vulnerable point of a Bush or of a Perry or of whoever one of his main rivals would have been, and he hammers that and exploits that. And that's been a very, very effective strategy that he's been able to use all along. Same thing in the general election. He focused on concerns about Clinton and her emails, for example. So I think he's doing the same thing here, is that he's finding what seems to be the vulnerable points, understanding with Biden how the concerns about his inappropriate touching might have a dramatic impact in terms of many people not within the Democratic Party willing to support him. And you're right. The polls are suggesting right now, if polls could be believed, and generally they can be, oftentimes, but not always, if polls could be believed, Biden is a formidable challenger to Donald Trump in 2020. And I think Trump is smart from his perspective to start going after Biden and weaken him now.
Right. You know, let me ask you this, because the polls do show Joe Biden with a significant lead. Granted, Bernie Sanders is pretty much right there with him as well. We're still, a year from now, we'll be in the thick of it, won't we?
We will be in the thick of it.
You know, so it's not that far away anymore. I mean, it's really 10 months we're talking about for the Iowa caucuses.
And even quicker if we think about the fact that in this August will be the Iowa straw poll.
There you go.
Yeah, so we're looking at now, if I can count my fingers and toes, we're looking at about six months, and we're really going to be in the middle of the Iowa straw polls at that point, yeah.
Historically, how accurate are the polls 5, 6, 10 months out when it comes to presidential races?
Not overly accurate, because I still think campaigns matter. At the end of the day, candidates can campaign and do a good job, do a bad job. Trends emerge in terms or events happen that can change campaigns. Now, my profession, political science, there's a whole group of people who argue that you can make predictions about a year in advance based upon the state of the economy and a few other variables. I'm not quite that hardcore that says that that we can predict that far out with pinpoint accuracy, because most of those models don't work, and again, they ignore campaigns. The other thing, which I will start now, the 2020 campaign season now, by reminding everybody, is remember also the aggregate national polls don't matter, because what? We don't elect people by popular vote.
There you go.
We elect them by the Electoral College. In 2016, the polls at the end of the election said Clinton would win by the national popular vote by 2 to 3 points. What did she win the national popular vote by? About 2 to 3 points. The polls got it exactly right. But the real battle, this is what my research is all about, is about what? It's about the 51 state election, 50 states plus District of Columbia, the battle for the Electoral College, and more importantly, It's those 10 or 12 swing states that really determine everything. So what we really should be having our conversation on is where Trump versus Biden sit in places like Florida, Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania. That would tell me far more at this point.
All right, chatting here with Professor David Schultz about the election. You know, you mentioned something that's really interesting and that I have a further question on. You mentioned how important women voters are. Obviously, they're important for Republicans, and Donald Trump did get a lot of support from women. But you're saying that they're even more important to Democrats. And I'm wondering if the problems that are cropping up with Joe Biden right now, and granted, he hasn't even announced his candidacy, added to a layer of people are bound to look back on his career, and it's a long one. There's a lot there to look at. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that is in his background is he was the chair of the Judiciary Committee during the Anita Hill hearings. And there are an awful lot of feminists especially who were less than thrilled with how he behaved towards Anita Hill. Is this something that makes him potentially vulnerable?
I think it does. And again, just a couple statistics here. If we go back to the 2018 elections last year, 52% of the voters in the United States were female. So women are the majority voters now. And again, and we're seeing that more consistently now because women are a majority of the population now, slightly, but they're seeming to be more likely to turn out to vote than if we had this conversation, let's say, 20 or 25 years ago. And you're right. We have to think of the fact that there are, within that spectrum of female voters, lots of different groups, and included within that are going to be some women who do remember the Anita Hill hearings, you know, in which he didn't seem to press Clarence Thomas anywhere near as hard as he should, and resulting in the fact that I think some of his questioning and the questioning of others was highly skeptical towards Professor Hill at that point, you know, regarding her allegations of sexual harassment by Clarence Thomas. So I think that's going to affect some people. I think that these allegations that are surfacing now, you know, that have just come up in the last week or two, will also resonate, I think, with, let's say, younger voters, where the Me Too movement seems to be even more solid in terms of drawing clear lines in the sand regarding acceptable and unacceptable behavior. That's why I come back to something we were saying a few months ago here. I think it's going to be really critical regarding how Biden responds to these comments, and also at the same time, how do female voters place his past behavior and what he's saying within a larger context and saying, okay, I don't like what he's doing, but we got to get rid of Donald Trump, or do they say we have able candidates in Amy Klobuchar, Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, Kristen Gillibrand, and therefore, you know, we have alternatives.
All right, chatting here with Professor David Schultz. We have to take a quick break. So much, as always, to talk about. Want to talk after our break. We've got to give you some weather here. But afterwards, want to talk about Amy Klobuchar. Talk about Kristen Gillibrand. Talk about Cory Booker and Kamala Harris and see how he thinks these other candidates are stacking up. And, of course, Bernie Sanders in the Democratic field. So keep it here. You're listening to News Talk 830. When we come back, we'll give you some weather and then more with Professor David Schultz. It is 8:36 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy, along with Professor David Schultz, we are talking the presidential race here. What are your thoughts about how the other Democratic candidates are faring? Obviously, Bernie Sanders doing very well on top of the polls with Joe Biden. One candidate that I think is doing remarkably well is the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. He is only 37 years old. He is gay. He is married to another man. His name is Pete Buttigieg. And he has really done well in terms of fundraising. and was had a breakout performance in a CNN town hall, which CNN has been giving to all of the candidates if they have wanted it, apparently. Your thoughts about Buttigieg and some of the other candidates and also Klobuchar?
Okay, so let's start with, given the fact that Joe Biden hasn't officially declared yet, so we'll just say among declared candidates, you have to put right now what? Bernie Sanders as the leader, both in terms of where he's polling and also in terms of his fundraising. So he's clearly the front runner right now. And then if we were looking both in terms of polling and in terms of dollars, second becomes Senator Kamala Harris from California. Then we now start to get a tighter pack where he, along with Elizabeth Warren, you know, seem to be, you know, let's say at that, let's say that third or fourth position. And he's come out of nowhere. He's raised an incredible amount of money, you know, very, very quickly. What's $7 or $8 million or something like that. And he seems to be, I don't know, he seems to be the buzz of the town right now where everybody's talking about him. So that would be probably be my first tier at this point in terms of candidates. Unfortunately for Senator Klobuchar, she doesn't seem to be making a lot of traction. She declared, she raised what we think was about $1 million or so very quickly. But, you know, at the end of the first quarter, candidates will release, you know, which meant at the end of March, will release their fundraising, you know, to show how well they're doing. She's really not released her numbers yet publicly or made a big deal out of it. Many people are speculating that after that initial declaration, she didn't really raise a lot of money. She still seems to be hovering at about 2-3% in the polls. I'm going to say that her campaign right now seems to be stuck, and she doesn't seem to be really getting a lot of traction that I can see. But I think her whole strategy is still what? It's doing well in Iowa, and I think maybe the last time we talked about Klobuchar, we mentioned the fact that while Iowa has oftentimes been a good strategy for candidates, less than half the time does a candidate who wins Iowa goes on to win the nomination. And on top of which, this year, when Iowa holds its caucuses, will be the starting early voting for California for its primary. That changes things dramatically.
Right. And it will be interesting. It also, if Joe Biden fades, I think it's fair to say that Senator Amy Klobuchar is probably one of the few other moderates in the race.
Yes. And so I think you're right. I think if Biden does enter the race, we're doing a lot of obviously guessing here, I think he hurts her significantly. But on the other hand, if Biden doesn't enter the race or falls apart, I think she stands probably to benefit more so than almost any of the other candidates out there, because I would say in many ways, Biden and Klobuchar are probably politically or ideologically closer to one another than, let's say, Klobuchar is to a Sanders or to a Harris or to a let us say, you know, to even a Cory Booker.
All right. Gillibrand also seems to be not doing particularly well. This is a senator from New York, and she is the one who was the first to call on Senator Al Franken to resign, and that has haunted her throughout this campaign. Cory Booker still doing pretty well. I mean, the breakout of sort of the lesser knowns seems to be this Mayor Buttigieg.
Well, you're right, and he's somebody who I wouldn't have called, I don't think any of us would have called, let's say 2 months ago, as somebody likely to break out. If I were going to make any kind of calls 2 months ago, I would have thought that somebody, again, like a Cory Booker would be doing even better than he is doing. I would have thought, you know, that I think Klobuchar would have done a little bit better than I think she's doing right now. But I wouldn't have even seen Buttigieg on the screen in terms of somebody. In fact, when he first declared, I'm thinking, sure, the mayor of South Bend at 37 is going to run for office. You know, that's not going to get him very far in life.
Right, and he does seem to be doing remarkably well. Well, listen, let's take a quick break right now, and when we come back, we're going to shift to the local scene, and let's talk about what's going on at the legislature and also Governor Tim Walz's State of the State address. So Keep it right here, folks. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with Professor David Schultz to talk about the battle at the legislature. Obviously, differences shaping up in terms of funding. Can they reach an agreement by May 20th when the session is supposed to end? This is the year they've got to get a budget, folks. They can't just leave it open-ended once again. So we'll chat about that when we come back. It is 8:45 on a Saturday evening. Esme Murphy, along with Professor David Schultz. Let's switch to local politics and the State of the State address. Governor Tim Walz facing off against Republicans. It does not look like there's any agreement at all when it comes to this gas tax that the governor says is something that he wants to see. He was talking about a 20-cent increase. He feels he has a mandate. Republicans are saying, no, you don't.
Yeah. Let's first start with the speech. It was an exceedingly well-delivered speech. I don't know if you listened to it, but
yeah, he's very good at giving a speech. I mean, he didn't use a teleprompter. He used an outline,
right?
And it was just he's very good. I mean, some people are just that's their thing. He's very good at it.
I was going to say, as one teacher speaking about another teacher, I thought he did an exceedingly good job delivering a lesson plan. Having said all of that, I don't think he changed a single Republican's mind in the legislature. I think the Democrats loved him. If you watched the applauses, who was more vociferous, who was applauding more, Democrats versus Republicans. But at the end of the day, he didn't move the Republicans on probably any of his agenda, but especially on that 20-cent a gallon tax. And that really is pretty critical because so much of what he wants to do in terms of the infrastructure is hinged upon that. But also we should think in terms of not just the gas tax. You know, there are many things that he wants to do in his budget. And the Republicans at this point and the Democrats seem to be an incredibly long distance apart on a lot of things. And I know it's too early to start talking about, or maybe it's not too early to start talking about the fact that we might have to go to special session, but I think the gap is so large right now that I don't know how easy it's going to be to narrow that between now and May 20th.
And the problem is that this is one of the years where they've got to get a budget done because if they don't, you run the risk of a shutdown.
No, you're right. Remember, for people who don't know, it's a biennial budget.
It's confusing. I mean, Minnesota's system, who's covered it for years, it's confusing.
It is very confusing. So what happens is that we do budgets for 2 years at a time. And so after, in odd years like this, I mean, like, you know, in numerically odd years, I don't mean odd in terms of strange, but numerically odd years, the state makes a two-year budget. Under our Constitution, we're supposed to have the work done by I think what the Constitution says, they have to adjourn under our Constitution by the third Tuesday after the first Tuesday after the third Monday in May. I think that's what it says there. So May 20th this year, they have to have it done. And the track record in Minnesota hasn't been good in the last few years in terms of getting this biannual budget done. And if we don't get the budget done, we run the risk, as we've seen, of the partial government shutdown because our budget year, our new fiscal year in Minnesota, starts on July 1st. And so if we don't make that May 20th deadline, we technically still have till July 1st, you know, to get the job done before a partial shutdown. But talk to local governments, talk to school districts that get money from the state of Minnesota, and getting things done closer to July 1st as opposed to early in May is a problem because they're making decisions, especially with schools, on what, how many teachers they're going to hire, classroom size, and so forth. So this is a big one. They have to get it done because if they don't get it done, especially if they don't get it done by July 1st, we go into a partial government shutdown.
The governor is convinced that he has a mandate, and he did win a decisive victory in November. and the House, the entire Minnesota House was up, and that flipped to the Democratic side. The Republican-controlled Senate was not up for election. So I think the governor really, I think, genuinely believes he's got this mandate there. Yet the Republicans say, hey, we're still here. We're not going anywhere. Somebody's going to have to blink here. Do the Republicans have less to lose, and so they won't blink?
Yeah, they definitely have less to lose. Now, first, the governor can claim a mandate, so can the Democrats, but the Republicans can come back and say two things. First, governor, you only won 22 of the 87 counties in the state. Republicans still won geographically more area of the state, and we still control the Senate. And on top of which, the Republicans, I think, I have to keep in mind that the last time several Republicans voted in favor of a gas tax, all the Republicans who voted in favor of it lost their positions or were primary or were out of office at the next election. So I think this is a message that's not lost on Republicans, that they can't support a tax increase. On top of which, I'll throw one more thing in here, is that I think the Republicans would love to be able to say, going into the 2020 elections next year, win the entire House and Senate up for election, they'd like to be able to say, listen, the governor ran on taxes, increasing taxes, we opposed him. The governor ran on this agenda, he couldn't get it done. The Democrats and the governor ran on saying they're going to run government well. We had to go into another, overtime session. I think the Republicans have very, very little to lose next year, and they may be banking on the fact that, with Donald Trump on the ticket, they might do fairly well in Minnesota next year.
Right. So that'll be interesting to see. I can't imagine that either side would be willing to take this to a shutdown.
I would hope not, especially given we just went through the longest but the federal government shutdown in history, and we've had a pattern of shutdowns in Minnesota. Whatever I want to say, I can't imagine somebody would be willing to do that.
Something happens.
it happens because the political, even though collectively we are all better off not having the government shut down, the individual political interests don't favor that the governor has his interests. The Democratic legislators have theirs. The Republican legislators have their interests, and they're not lining up. And that's the recipe for the shutdown when we have divided government and different interests. And that's something we should also, again, remind listeners of, the fact that we are the only state in the country where the legislature is split. And by that,
remarkable to me.
Yeah, every other state in the country, either both houses of the legislature are Democrat or both are Republican, except for Nebraska, which is a single house. We are the only one in the country with a split legislature, and that makes the politics in Minnesota even more difficult than it is, let us say, in most states in the country.
Right. And again, I go back to what I was talking about, is if the Republicans, and we won't know if the Republicans had been up, would they have flipped as well?
Right.
It's very possible, and I think that's what the governor sometimes is looking at. That being said, and obviously there are some big problems when it comes to these monetary issues, and the bottom line, that's the ball game there. There still has been movement on some key bills that are very important in terms of, you know, the quality of life, in terms of issues like distracted driving, opioid issues, you know, tighter rein on that, where both parties are agreeing, and that is something, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's important, that underneath, I think, some of the noise, we are seeing a few things getting done, but where I think the big issues that really divide are tax and spend at the end of the day. It's the issues over the gas tax, renewal of the medical provider tax. It is over the fact that the Republicans in the Senate are proposing a state budget I think it's approximately $2 billion less than the governor. So on some, I'm going to say, of the big picture philosophical issues about the role of government and in terms of the economy, in terms of our society, and in terms of, let's say, generating revenue and taxes, this is where I think the big divides are between the governor, the House Democrats, and the Senate Republicans.
And this medical tax is one that was set to go away. It's been in place.
Right.
And so there's a debate about whether to continue it or not.
Right. And that's that generates $700 million a year. That's a big chunk of money. And I mention this because the governor's current budget presupposes that that tax will be renewed. His plans for infrastructure presuppose that the 20 cent per gallon increase on the gas tax will be supported. If, let's just say, those two things don't happen, and I think it's very unlikely that we're going to see either of them supported by the Republicans, that blows an enormous hole in the governor's budget that I think possibly makes it look like the governor and the Democrats have more to lose in this one than the Republicans do.
And the thing about the gas tax, too, is that, yes, and there's no question that Governor Tim Walz made it incredibly clear that he was campaigning on a gas tax. But the figure that he was kind of throwing out there was a figure that would have been about a 10-cent gas tax. And I think a lot of people kind of drew a sharp breath when he revealed 20. Did he miscalculate there? Because if so, it's a rare miscalculation to a guy who seems remarkably politically savvy.
Yeah, I think everybody knew he was going to propose a gas tax. And I think you're right. 5 cents, 10 cents is what everybody was prepared for. I'm still not sure if Republicans would have supported it, but I think you're definitely correct, is that he didn't lay the groundwork for what seems to be a pretty significant tax increase or gas tax increase in Minnesota. And I think that is making it exceedingly hard for him to make his case at this point. Now, his State of the State speech, he tried to highlight that by referencing places like Highway 14 in southern Minnesota.
You mentioned, you know, an accident that killed somebody he knew.
That's right. But I'm still not sure he's won the debate, because the Republicans will come back and say, yes, we agree that we need to do this, but we think we can do all this by a shift in spending priorities and not by a gas tax increase.
All right. Well, Professor David Schultz, it is always a pleasure. Great to talk to you after quite a long time here on the radio.
Well, I think so. And hopefully we'll be doing more of this again, I think, as the basketball season comes to an end.
Absolutely. All right. Thank you so much. The one and only Professor David Schultz. I invite you to tune in to his blog. It's a great blog. I want to thank Shaletta Brundage. I want to thank Jonathan Lowe and also the wonderful producer of this show, Susan Blanche. Have a great Saturday night, everyone.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.